Hello and welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We got open forum for you this hour. That means any question at all about the Catholic faith is welcome from anyone at all. We especially, let me just throw it out there. I, once again, still have not had a call from a Buddhist person in a long time. So if you're Buddhist, you're welcome to call. If you practice Hindu faith, you're welcome to call. If you're a Christian of any kind, if you're a Catholic, if you're no religion at all, you're welcome to call. That's what open forum means. But it also means that any question at all about the Catholic faith is welcome. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. And I have to say, when our guest this hour is here, we usually are quite liberal in allowing a great variety of questions, including questions of a more generally philosophical or religious nature. And that means that our guest is Jimmy Akin. Hi, Jimmy Akin.
Hey, how you doing?
I am very well, thank you.
So, you know, you said like Buddhist people could call and Hindu people could call and people with no religion could call. What if someone were, say, a pseudoscientific evolutionary pantheist? Could they call?
That would depend. Are they still alive?
Well, I think they'd have to be to call.
Yeah, then they can call, yes.
Okay.
They could. That sounds very familiar, however.
Oh, does it? Okay.
Yes, it does. But I don't want to give any maybe I'll just let this topic go. That sounds like a very interesting religion to have.
Uh-huh. Not a lot of people have that.
Not a lot of people
have
that.
Some very famous people have had it.
Not necessarily famous in a good way.
No, infamous. Infamous people.
Infamous people, yes. But I don't know if I'm supposed to name who that might be.
No, you can name who that might be.
Oh, okay. That might be the religion of Adolf Hitler.
That's correct. Yeah, that was Adolf Hitler's religion.
Yeah. Could you say it again?
He was a pseudoscientific evolutionary pantheist.
Yeah, right. Right.
And how might people find out about that?
They could go to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Yeah,
that is the current issue.
Current episode.
Yeah, current episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. I didn't know if I was supposed to say that because I didn't know if it would ruin the tease of what is Hitler's religion.
No, I wouldn't bring it up if I had a concern about that.
Well, let me ask you this, Jimmy Akin.
Okay.
So you got this podcast, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and you got ghosts on there, and you do the Antichrist, you do Bigfoot, you do pretty much any mystery you're willing to tackle.
Lots of mysteries.
When you look at the popularity, like you go, oh, this was a very popular one. This one was not so popular. Where does Hitler's religion fall?
Are people very popular?
People are interested in Hitler's religion.
So, for example, the previous week's episode was on the Phoenix Lights UFO incident, which was the biggest mass UFO sighting in American history, or certainly recent American history. Lots of people saw it. Thousands of people saw it. Took video, pictures, all that stuff, because it happened in the 90s, and it did well. But in one day, the Hitler's religion episode got as many views on YouTube as the previous week's show had gotten in a week.
Yeah. Oh, so people
so very popular. That and weight loss, the mystery of weight loss episode were
well. There's
very
maybe some
too.
Enlightened self interest there.
Yeah.
But okay, so
Before I put up the weight loss episode, someone saw that it was coming and was like, "How is weight loss a mystery?" It's like you obviously have not struggled with this.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So one thing we do know for certain, Hitler baptized the Catholic,
right?
And sometimes it is implied that. He was a Christian himself or a practicing Catholic, but is there any evidence of any of that?
No, he really he was baptized a Christian and a Catholic, but his mother was a devout Catholic. His father was not. His father was like a free thinker, and Adolf Hitler took after his father. So by the time he went to be confirmed, he like grudgingly went through with it. But according to people who were there, the priest had to like drag the words out of him.
Oh.
And so he was already at a very young age – rejecting
Hitler
this.
Was a surly teen,
or even younger, and then he just abandoned the practice of religion in early adulthood, and he, even though he would early on in his political career, he would try to make it sound like he's a Christian. He hated Christianity so much he couldn't even just say, "Yeah, I'm a Christian." He had to have this bizarre, but I'm a positive Christian, by which I mean, and then he had this
basically not a Christian,
right. And so like he would use Jesus as a symbol of struggle because, you know, he's like all about struggle and everything. Mein Kampf is his, My Struggle is his big book.
Yeah.
And so he liked that he could use Jesus as an image of a fighter against Jewish whatever. But then he he did not believe that Jesus' death redeemed anybody. He apparently thought Jesus was just a man. Right. He did not think he was resurrected. Mm-hmm. So this is – and then his quote-unquote positive Christianity meant, according to him, a fighting Christianity that would not hesitate to use the fist and the sword.
Right.
And it's like, okay, that's not really love your neighbor, dude.
No. So. He missed that. Right. I'm a positive Christian.
Yeah.
It's just cover. Word Christian in there.
Right.
But it's cover for the same thing he believed.
And then when you look at what he really believed, it's like, okay, well, he believed that the universe nature is God. So that's why he's a pantheist.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had this whole struggle of the races thing. So that's where evolution fits in.
Yeah.
He thought he was being scientific by having – you know, evolution is a prominent.
But he didn't understand.
But he didn't understand the science of evolution.
Yeah.
So that's why he's pseudoscientific.
Yeah. And he wasn't a very good painter either. 888-318.
Had trouble with the human form for some reason.
He painted a picture of Mary and the baby Jesus.
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
It is terrible. It's horrible. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just so.
Baby Jesus has like a sword. And...
No. Just baby Jesus is. There's just no beauty in it. Mm-hmm. No, there's no beauty in it at all. It's a painting, but it has no – it's just blank.
I haven't seen that one. I have seen and I've heard art critics talk about how his paintings mostly don't have humans in them.
Right.
He'll
right.
like do pictures of buildings and landscapes and things like that, but not people.
That's why they told him to go be an architect. That's the advice that he got from the art teachers. Probably the rest of that was, or just go anywhere. Just don't be here. 888-318-7884. Enough conversation about Hitler's religion. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. I would just mention again, though, if you do want to know more about Hitler's religion, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is the place to go. Just put that in the Google machine and it will pop up. Are you ready for questions, Jimmy?
I've been ready.
You?
I was born ready.
Okay. Chad in New York, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Chad, your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon.
Hi.
So my family just recently moved to New York, and my son is 7 years old. He's going through preparing for First Communion.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. The issue is the diocese or our parish is trying to have the kids sing a song during their First Communion Mass, and there's a line in the song that I find very problematic.
Okay, what's that?
And when I brought it up, what's that?
What's the line?
So it's, Peter built his church on the rock of our faith.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Peter didn't build a church. Jesus did. It's not Peter's church. It's Jesus's. Mm-hmm. And Jesus built it on the rock of Peter.
Okay. So what happened when you brought this up?
There was pushback. They said, oh, we've been doing this for a very long time, and it's a very standard song.
Mm-hmm. And who did you bring it up with?
The director of religious education.
Okay. So I understand your concern. I would say that the song's line is confusing, and especially for children, it could be confusing given other things that the church says. So it didn't strike me as a great song. And ultimately, the person in charge at the parish level is going to be the pastor. So you could always, if you don't get satisfaction with the DRE, you could always go to the pastor and talk to him about it. You may or may not get him to change it. But if they don't change it, I wouldn't stress about it too much, because even though it is potentially misleading or confusing, it's not false. While if you just think in terms of Matthew 16:18, You have Matthew 16:18. In that verse, Jesus says, I will build my church on you, Peter, or on this rock, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Well, even in that verse, the church has understood the rock in more than one way. In one way, it refers to Peter, and by extension, his successors, the popes. But it's also always throughout church history been understood as a symbol that that refers to more than one thing. The fancy term for that is it's a polyvalent symbol. That just means it refers to more than one thing. So one of the things it refers to is clearly Peter, but it also has been seen as referring to additional things like faith in Jesus Christ or the faith or things like that. And in fact, if you look in the Catechism of the Catholic Church today, it interprets the rock two different ways. So this is actually something the church is quite comfortable with. As long as you're not denying that it's Peter, you can see additional meanings in there. Then that leaves us with the question of, can Peter be seen as building the church? Well, in Matthew 16:18, Peter is not the builder of the church. Jesus is the one that image presents us as being the builder of the church. But we have other passages in Scripture. And so, for example, if you look at 1 Corinthians 3, Paul's talking about building churches, and he says, no man can lay a foundation other than Jesus Christ, but then I, like a master builder, built this construction of the church on the foundation of Jesus Christ. And he talks about other people doing the same thing, other ministers of the gospel, being builders of the church. And so if Paul can do that in God's inspired word and conceive of himself as a builder of the church, then certainly Peter could be conceived of as a builder of the church as well. And so so you could say Peter built his church, namely the church that Peter was involved in building. Ultimately, it's Jesus's, but you can speak this way. And he built it on our faith. Well, if we didn't respond to the message of the gospel in faith, then we wouldn't be part of his church, Jesus's church, or the one that Peter helped build. And so you could say there's a sense in which you can envision our faith in Christ as being foundational to our membership in the church, and thus as a foundation of the church, symbolically speaking. So I understand that because of the tension between the way this line is phrased and the way many people, including especially children who are just learning the faith, will understand Matthew 16:18. I understand there's tension there and it can cause confusion, but it's not flatly false. There is a way in which you can understand the song lyric based on how you've described it in an Orthodox Catholic sense. And so if they don't want to change it, I would say it's unfortunate, but it's not the end of the world. And I would just make sure that your own son understands the sense in which it can be understood acceptably.
Chad, I hope that was helpful to you. We got to head to a break. Before we do, I want you to know we've got a free ebook available to anyone who would like it at shop.catholic.com, Making the Most of Lent, a Spiritual Companion. You just go over to shop.catholic.com. There will be a banner there that says free ebook. Click that and you will get your free copy of Making the Most of Lent, a Spiritual Companion.
Can a moral relativist object to God's goodness based on the problem of evil? The answer is no, at least when it comes to moral evil. And here's the reason. You see, moral relativism states no moral truths exist independently of the individual. That's to say, what is right and wrong is relative to what the individual determines. Now, how can a relativist deviation from his own moral standard be considered morally evil when there's nothing to oblige him to follow his moral standard? The answer is, it can't. But if no moral evil can exist within the mental framework of moral relativism, well then obviously a relativist's complaint about the problem of moral evil is useless. So the relativist either has to give up the complaint about the problem of moral evil to keep relativism, or give up relativism to keep the complaint about the problem of moral evil. The relativist can't have both. I'm Carlo Broussard with a ready reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
The devil will always do his best to tempt you into sin until you get to that place where you love sin. That's what he wants. He wants you down there with him. And not because he loves you, he hates you. When you do what the enemy tempts you to do, he does it out of pure hatred.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of many things, including his latest book, Teaching with Authority.
The latest published one.
You didn't make me laugh right when I'm trying to introduce you and share your book title. Or you didn't know I was going to laugh?
I didn't know you were going to laugh.
Okay. All right. Our number, of course, 888-318-7884.
I do have two more recent books, though, that are in the press right now.
Okay.
So I did 20 Answers New Testament.
I remember that. Yep.
And I also just turned in 20 Answers Protestantism.
Oh, great. That seems so odd that we don't have – I mean, those
– well. Now we do.
Now we do. Like, those seem very...
took me about a week of writing time to do each one. So
wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That's, well...
Less than that for New Testament, but...
I know, because that's really when, right in your wheelhouse.
New that Testament. Was really right in my wheelhouse. With Protestantism, it's like, okay, I know all this stuff, but I want to go check all my, you know... Because when you're dealing with dozens of different viewpoints, you want to make sure you're saying them exactly right... Mm-hmm. You know, and not misrepresenting what anyone is saying.
Right, right. Let's go to Bruno in Vancouver, Canada, watching on YouTube Live. Okay. Thanks for the call, Bruno. Your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. Good afternoon.
Yeah, likewise.
So my question in a nutshell is this. I was raised Catholic, did First Communion, but never did my confirmation. And when I was a kid, I decided to be an idiot atheist for 20 years. I moved to Canada. My wife decided to go to a Protestant church. And at first I was like, okay, no, nonsense. Okay, makes sense. And then I'm towards faith again. My question is, will I go to hell if I continue going to the Protestant church? Or no, I still have salvation, or I have to go back to Catholic church?
Okay, Bruno.
There's no way to answer this question in a single yes or no, yes, you're going to heaven, or no, you're not going to heaven way, because it depends on additional factors. The fundamental thing it depends on is, are you in a state of grace? Are you in God's friendship when you die? And there are Catholics who are in a state of grace when they die and go to heaven. There are Catholics who are not in a state of grace when they die and don't go to heaven. There are Protestants who are in a state of grace when they die and go to heaven. There are Protestants who are not in a state of grace when they die and they don't go to heaven. So the fundamental thing is, are you in a state of grace? Are you dying in God's friendship? And for that to happen, for you to die in a state of grace, you need to have repented, you need to have faith in Christ, you need to be baptized, and you need to not commit mortal sin. Mortal sin is a sin that you know is gravely contrary to God's will, and even though you know that, you say, I don't care, I'm just doing my own thing, and I'm okay with that. I know God really, really, really wants me to do this other thing. I just don't care. I'm doing my own thing. That's a mortal sin. Now, what does church membership have to do with mortal sin? Well, Jesus in Matthew 16:18 says, I will build my church, singular, not plural, not my churches. And that tells us that Jesus has a church that that is one church, one single body of his followers that constitute his church, in contrast to other churches that aren't his and other assemblies, ecclesia, that aren't his. And so what else do we know about this church? Well, it's founded on Peter, and he says the gates of hell will not prevail against it, so it's not going to pass out of existence. It's not going to die. It's not going to be overcome by the powers of death. And so that means that Jesus has a church with identifiable leadership, like Peter,
which has existed since the first century. And the Catholic Church fits that description. But if Jesus then says, this is my church, we can infer from that he wants us to be part of it. And to knowingly separate oneself from Jesus' church and say, I don't care, Jesus set up this church, I don't want to be a member of it, I'm just not going to do that. Well, to do that knowingly and deliberately could be a mortal sin, and it could impair one's salvation as a result. Now, not everybody who is separated from the Catholic Church has committed a mortal sin. Lots of people, you know, they're raised in the Protestant Church, and they never consciously separated from it. They would, if you said, hey, did you know the Catholic Church is Jesus' church? They would say, oh, no, it's not. And they've never seen the evidence. They've never thought about the evidence that would lead them to the conclusion that it is. And so they're innocently unaware of this. And so they're not, by not being Catholic, they're not knowingly and deliberately rejecting membership in Jesus' church. Other people, they may have been raised Catholic, but they weren't given a good Catholic upbringing. They weren't given a background in the Catholic faith. They then encountered other, and this may be your situation, Bruno, I don't know, I can't judge your heart, but they then encountered Christians of another stripe and who said things that seemed reasonable to them. And so it's not like they said, oh, I know the Catholic Church is Jesus' church and I just don't care. Well, you know, that might not be a mortal sin. On the other hand, people can be pretty good about rationalizing things too. Even when something is a grave sin and they know it on some level, they can talk themselves into, oh, this affair isn't actually really wrong because my spouse doesn't really love me, or I just need to scratch this itch once in a while or something. I still love my spouse. And they'll rationalize stuff.
Yeah.
And that can happen on any sin, including separating from Jesus' church. So I can't tell you one way or another what the state of your heart is. That's something between you and God. I can tell you God loves you. I can tell you that God makes salvation possible for you. I can tell you that he will provide evidence for you if you're open to studying the evidence for the Catholic faith. He'll make it available to you. That's one of my favorite promises in the Gospel of John, where Jesus says that if any man's will is to do God's will, he will find out if the teaching is true or not. God will make sure he gets the evidence he needs. So I would encourage you to be open to the faith of your upbringing and to study it and to look at the evidence. We're here to answer questions on the air for you. We have loads of resources available for you at Catholic.com, just there online for free. You can call us up off the air and ask questions if they're longer than what we can deal with here on live radio. But we're here to serve you, and God bless you for asking the question and being open enough to God's grace to ask the question. And I just want to encourage you to go forward and to trust God to lead you.
Bruno, I hope that was helpful to you. Thank you so much for that call. Let us go now to David in San Diego, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. What? You can't just listen on the radio in San Diego?
Funny that.
Isn't that funny?
You could
think you'd be hi, David. Sorry. We were talking over you for a minute. Your question for Jimmy.
So I have this theology topic that when people present it to me, some of my atheist friends, I just don't know how to counter it.
Okay, what is it?
So I fully understand that God does not send people to hell through our own free will. We choose to go to hell. Mm-hmm. But what I cannot wrap my head around or answer is, why would God, who is all loving and all knowing, create someone from the beginning, knowing that, you know, 20 to 40 years from now, this person is destined to hell?
Okay, so this is a common question, and we've got a break coming up, so we'll see how much of this question we can answer before the break. But I want you to know that I'll make sure to finish it if I'm not able to get to the whole thing. The question as asked presupposes that God has a certain kind of knowledge. It presupposes that God knows what a person would do if he created the person, and that God knows that prior to the – logically prior, because it's all outside of time, but he knows that logically prior to the act of creating the person, so that if God foresees this person will choose to go to hell, he could then not create the person. So it presupposes that God has knowledge of what people will do if he creates them, and that he could therefore refrain from creating them. So the question is, does God have that kind of knowledge? Well, we know that God has certain kinds of knowledge. He has what's sometimes called, and I'm going to try to avoid technical terms as much as I can, but he knows all possible things because he can run every permutation of everything that could happen. So he knows all possibilities. He also knows all actualities because he can look at the world and see what's actual in it, what's real. So he definitely knows everything that's possible and everything that's actual. The question is, does he know these things that if he didn't make it actual, would he still know the outcome of free will? And that's what we'll talk about on the other side of the break.
Hang on, David. Thank you very much. It is Open Forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest, right back with more of that right after this.
A generation ago, Christian parents didn't have to worry about how to explain transgenderism to their 9-year-old children or help their teenager deal with mockery at school for believing in traditional marriage. But today, as our culture decays, we have to know how to talk to our children about these issues. In Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues, Layla Miller and Trent Horn give parents the crucial tools and techniques to form children with the understanding they need, appropriate to their age and maturity level, to meet the world's challenges. If we're not teaching our children how to understand tough moral issues, then the world will. Read Made This Way and learn how to give your kids a firm foundation on which to build a life of moral clarity and happiness. Order your copy of Made This Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or logging onto the shop at Catholic.com.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew she wanted those things, that in them, somehow, she would find God. Over the years, as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Open Forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and we were in the midst of a conversation with David here in San Diego, listening on the Catholic Answers app, because you can't listen on the radio here. Jimmy, you wanted to finish your...
So God has at least a couple kinds of knowledge that all Orthodox Catholic theologians agree that he has. One is a knowledge of all possibilities. If something's possible, God knows it. Another is the knowledge of all actualities. If someone does something in history so that it's an actual event, God knows that.
Yeah.
The question, though, is would God know what someone would freely do if he created them, even if he didn't create them?
Mm-hmm.
So
it
kind of falls between mere possibility and actuality. Because if, let's say, there's a hypothetical person, God never really creates him. We'll call him Cy Kellett, okay? And so God's thinking about Cy Kellett, who he could create but mm-hmm. doesn't.
Yeah.
And he wonders, will Cy Kellett freely choose to die in my friendship or not?
Okay.
Well, it's possible that Cy Kellett could die in God's friendship like any other human being. It's possible that Cy Kellett could use his free will so that he doesn't die in God's friendship.
Right.
And so both of those are possibilities. God knows that.
Okay.
But since God doesn't actually make Cy Kellett, there's no actual event in world history where Cy Kellett dies in God's friendship or not. So God doesn't know, does Cy actually do that? So there would need for God to be able to say, I'm going to not create Cy Kellett because he would free – if I create him, he will freely choose not to die in my friendship. God would have to have some kind of knowledge that kind of falls partway between his knowledge of the actual and his knowledge of the possible. And so theologians call that middle knowledge.
Okay.
And many theologians think God has middle knowledge. And if God has middle knowledge, then God – would be confronted with this dilemma. Do I create someone who I know is going to reject my grace in the end? And so let's suppose for a minute God has middle knowledge. How could we square this with his goodness, with his fundamental goodness? Well, one way that people have tried to do it is by saying God's still being fair with those people. He's not doing anything cruel to them. He gave them the chance to be saved, and they freely chose to reject it. So he's being square with them.
Yeah.
And in addition, some people have said, you know, it looks like he's actually being kind to them because it's better to exist even in a state where you're separated from God and experiencing the consequences of that. Still better to exist than not to exist.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we may not think of hell as being a net negative mm-hmm. for people. It may be a net positive. Is it going to involve some suffering? Sure. But so does this life, and this life is still a net positive.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe hell is the same way. And so in that case, God would actually be kind to someone by creating them and giving them free will, and even if they end up going to hell, it's still a net positive for them. So they're still coming out on the plus side, and that would square with God's goodness. So those are a couple of things you could explore as a way of saying, okay, God has middle knowledge, and that's how we explain this. But it's not church teaching
that
God has middle knowledge. It is a theological opinion that God has middle knowledge.
Okay.
And so consequently, there are other theologians, and this would include people like St. Thomas Aquinas, who would say, no, God doesn't have knowledge of what someone would choose if he made them, but he never made them.
Yeah.
Because that requires free will. And just like God can't know the shape of a four-sided triangle, that's just gibberish.
Yeah.
Because triangles by definition have three sides, not four.
So he can't know the choice a chooser would make without making the chooser.
He can't know. I would put it like this: he can't to talk about the result of a choice that is freely never made, or the result of a free will choice that is never made.
Yeah.
Is in the same category as a four-sided triangle.
Got it.
You have to have an actual choice to have an actual outcome.
Yeah.
Would be the argument. And so, consequently, if God doesn't have middle knowledge, then he doesn't have the option of not creating somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Based on what he foresees they're going to do, because he has to create them to see what they're going to do. And so he knows, sure, if I create Cy Kellett, he could die in my friendship or he could reject my friendship. But without you having a free will to choose that,
wow,
there's no outcome of a choice. And so God then has to say, okay, let there be Cy Kellett, at which point he sees you in history making the choice one way or another. But at that point, you exist. So he can't uncreate you after you exist in history. Because at that point, you're real.
David, thank you very, very much for that question. I hope that was helpful to you. I feel like I have a vested interest in this hypothetical character called Cy Kellett that you invented.
Yeah.
I'm really hoping that this particular character will die in friendship with
God. There are some serious issues here. Yeah.
So I suppose that person could just continue to have faith and receive the sacraments. That would be a good start.
And
maybe try to live
charitably. Avoid mortal sin.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, we just want him to have hope. That's the thing. Thanks, David. Let's go to Ryan in Washington. Ryan, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy.
Howdy.
Hi. My question involves, my family here. See, it starts off with me knowing that, you know, as being a Catholic, we are supposed to balance faith and find balance between faith and reason.
Okay. Ryan, it's a little hard to understand you. Can you please talk directly into your phone?
Sure.
Thank you.
As a Catholic, it's our job to always balance faith and reason and mm-hmm. apply that throughout our lives. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. And what I mean by that is, you know, We follow God's laws. We hold strong to our faith, but we also acknowledge the consensus of scientific discoveries and observations. But my biggest problem here is that I have parents who are very good, strong, devout Catholics. However, they ignore the consensus of science, like, for instance, climate change and the issues concerning it and many other things.
Okay.
And they tend to just blatantly shove aside the facts made by science and so forth and other things that were objective studies and empirical proof. Mm-hmm. And they'll hold steadfast to other more, they take more of a fundamentalist mm-hmm. approach rather than a faith and reason approach
okay.
to life. And I've tried to show them that And I've tried to explain to them that taking an approach that acknowledges both science and faith is perfectly compatible with our faith,
uh-huh.
our belief system. But they continue to deny this fact, and it's sort of like they continue to deny it and deny it and deny it.
Okay.
And there's no way of making them see this.
Ryan, I need to ask you for clarification on something. When you say they deny this fact, are you saying they are denying the fact that Catholics should take science seriously, or are you saying they're denying global warming?
Well, that's just an example.
Okay, but if you say to them Catholics should take science seriously and shouldn't automatically reject it, what do they say to that more general claim without going to specific examples? Would they say, "Yeah, Catholics should take it seriously," or would they say, "Oh no, Catholics shouldn't take science seriously"? What would their attitude be?
Well, it's pretty complex. There's no yes or no answer there, but it's uh-huh. a little mix.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is, you know, they'll say, no, this can't, because, you know, they buy into usually the more religious right-leaning.
Okay, again, you said this. What do you mean this? Is that global warming again, or is that something else?
Well, you know, generally, scientific studies, social, whether it's hard science, that entails global warming, or social science, considering politics mm-hmm. in society, regardless of it, they seem to side with the more evangelical Christian way of thinking and take a strong, more hard-by-the-book fundamentalist approach,
okay.
sort of like a strong, ultra-conservative approach to everything, whereas, you know, the average Catholic should try to stay in the middle and be very careful. But, you know, my parents tend to be, you know, very ultra-conservative, and I just hear them talk about this stuff over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And even though there have been objective studies proving, you know, like...
Proving what?
Certain things about the Earth, the climate, and social changes that, you know, for instance, the conservative media tends to deny.
Ryan, what would be an example of something in the social area that you think science has proven that your parents have a problem with? I need an extra example there.
Well, let's take illegal immigration, for instance.
Okay.
People on the Republican side. By the way, I am not a liberal person. I'm a very traditional thinking Catholic, but
uh-huh.
I take an independent approach.
Okay.
But back to the subject, I'm saying, you know, illegal immigration, for instance. My parents strongly believe.
Go ahead.
Immigration causes crime, whereas empirical evidence from countless social scientists and studies have shown that that is far from the truth. In fact, it may even cause crime to stagnate and decline, for instance.
So let me make sure I understand your claim. We are talking about not immigration, but illegal immigration, right?
Correct.
Okay. So you're saying illegal immigration does not result in a net increase in crime of any form. Is that it? Or is it a more
Yes.
specific form? Well, I would say I suspect you may mean something more specific than that, because it seems to me if someone is doing something illegal, that by definition means an increase in crime. If of some kind, it may not be violent crime, it may not be sexual crime, it may not be financial crime, or it may be. But I think we have to be careful about our terms here. Let me take a step back and talk about the science issue. So science is a fascinating field of endeavor. It's something I personally am a big fan of. I spend loads of my free time reading science books about all kinds of different subjects: physics, astronomy, cosmology, biology, geology, economics, mathematics. I love science. It's one of my big things. And one of my regular themes, both here on Catholic Answers Live and on my own podcast, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, is how to reconcile faith and reason, how to take both perspectives very seriously. So I'm on your side, Ryan, in that I think Catholics need to take science quite seriously, and they need to be open to the findings of science. They need to not automatically dismiss something that science has suggested because it's something that doesn't fit comfortably with their prior views. I think they need to be open to revising prior understandings of particular things in light of science. Having said that, I also, in part precisely because I study science and its history, I know the results of science are always provisional. And there have been major shifts in scientific understandings of how the world works over the course of time. And there is no particular reason to think we're at the end of those shifts. Now, hopefully, and this is more a matter of faith than a matter of anything else, hopefully we have an approximate understanding of the world that is better than prior understandings. And hopefully we won't see massive reinterpretations in the future of our understanding of things. Hopefully we're pretty much in the ballpark scientifically. But any true scientist will say there's no way of knowing that. We could find evidence tomorrow that would completely revolutionize our understanding of something. It's like back in the 1990s when we discovered dark energy. The debate had been, is the universe heavy enough? Is it massive enough to eventually slow the expansion of the universe caused by the Big Bang so that it will eventually recollapse on itself? Well, lo and behold, in the 1990s, we discovered not only is it not massive enough to close the expansion of the Big Bang, it's actually flying apart faster and faster. It's accelerating. And so there has to be some unknown force, call it dark energy, driving that expansion. And this was totally shocking when it was discovered in the 90s. So we have no guarantee that there aren't future shocks like that just around the corner in the history of science. I also know that scientists are not always unbiased. Scientists can have biases that show through in their work. This is something we also see in the history of science. In Nazi Germany, there was so-called German science. In Soviet Russia, there was Soviet science, that where you had particular ideologies of a scientific nature that caught on and that then became dominant in those places, and they ended up being undermined. Here in the West, we're subject to the same thing. To cite just one example, the USDA food pyramid that you used to see on all kinds of products. Well, that was received nutrition science by loads of people. But you know who came up with the nutrition pyramid? The USDA? Not the Centers for Disease Control, not the National Institutes for Health. It was the United States Department of Agriculture, whose interest is in dealing with the farm industry, not nutrition and what's best for people medically. And nevertheless, they had a big enough megaphone that they convinced lots of people that you should be eating all these carbohydrates and very little protein and fat. And that's not going to be healthy for everybody. So you have these same fads and fashions in science here in the West. If you – and like one of the daily sites I check on my on the internet is Real Clear Science, where they have a representative sampling of science stories from around the world. One of the things that's always popping up on Real Clear Science is the replication crisis in the social sciences and in psychology. Mm-hmm. It turns out all of these pivotal, seminal – psychology experiments that have been done and social science things cannot be duplicated. When people have tried to go and replicate the results and it turns out they can't be replicated, scientists are openly talking about a crisis in these areas because things they've taken for granted for so many decades suddenly can't be replicated, and it's thrown the whole area into an uproar. So I would say that when we're dealing – and frankly, when it comes to global warming, I'm open to the idea that the environment is warming up on average. I'm even open to the idea that humans are causing it. But I'm also skeptical of that because I see evidence in this area of the science being cooked. There was the Hide the Decline scandal a few years ago where it turns out the fundamental data that a lot of this these claims rested on could not be reproduced because it had been manipulated by the people who were keeping the spreadsheets. And specifically in their emails, they were talking about we need to do this because we need to hide the decline in the recent temperature data. And so that's something that I'm open, but I'm skeptical. When you talk about immigration, you're going to have to be much more specific about what kinds of crimes are we talking about, because illegally crossing a border is a crime. But, you know, if you want to say, well, there's no increase in violent crime, maybe, maybe not. I'd have to see the data. That's an empirical question. I don't know. So I would say that I would try to, in terms of dealing with your parents, my primary concern would be, are they right with God? If they're living lives of grace and faith and they're trying to follow God, the scientific issues are subsidiary because scientific knowledge is always provisional. It's wonderful to have. It's wonderful to know more about God's creation and to understand it even better and to use the gift of reason to explore it and admire its wonder. But scientific knowledge is always provisional. What's eternal is our knowledge of God and the faith, and that's what's most important in life. So I would say if your parents are living lives of faith, I would rejoice in that fact. I would look at these other issues and say, hey, maybe we can talk about these, but I wouldn't assume that just because something is popular in the science press right now that it's necessarily true. Scientists will always say this is all provisional. We could have major surprises around the corner. And so I wouldn't get too worked up if your parents don't buy some of the latest scientific ideas. You may think, oh, well, they should. There's really good evidence on this. But as long as they're living with God, that's what's most important.
Ryan, thank you very, very much. We got to take a quick break. Be right back with more right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Catholic Answers Live is proudly supported by CatholicChemistry.com, a new dating site for Catholics who want to do dating right and believe relationships start with Catholic chemistry. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicChemistry.com for their generous support on the web at CatholicChemistry.com.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
Fallen away Catholic years and years ago, doing my own thing. My mom and dad never gave up on me, and I know it was the Holy Rosary. And they kept after me, Philip, pray your rosary. Then eventually I did. I'm a member of the Knights of the Immaculata, Maximilian Kolbe's group. I'm with the Legion of Mary, and I haven't stopped leading the rosary in nursing homes, thanks be to God.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Back to Catholic Answers Live. Annual spring store-wide sale still underway. Everything's 15% off. When you go to the Catholic Answers shop, that's shop.catholic.com, just use the promo code SPRING19. Get 15% off your whole order. Let's go to Matthew in Abingdon, Virginia. Is that correct, Matthew?
Abingdon, yeah.
Abingdon, that's okay. All right.
Famous Protestant publishing house there.
I was not even aware. Mm-hmm. Is it named after the town or is it something?
Well, it's named Abingdon.
Oh, Abingdon Press.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Matthew, your question for Jimmy.
Yes. Hi, Jimmy Inside. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking my call this evening.
Sure thing.
My question is, I was curious, how as Catholics should we view the Crusades? I guess more specifically, how we could also look at the Knights Templar Order. I know that's garnered quite a bit of attention mm-hmm. With the new series that's now on the History Channel, Nightfall. Mm. And if, in addition to that, could you offer any sources that I might look at? I've done tried to do some research, and there's plenty of materials out there on the Crusades, but I've been trying to find something that looks at the Crusades and handles that subject fairly from a Catholic perspective.
So it's very difficult to offer an overall assessment of the Crusades as a body because each Crusade was different. They were – I mean the Crusades occurred over a number of centuries and they had different – markedly different results. I mean the First Crusade liberated a territory in the Holy Land that then became a Western-style kingdom that made the Holy Land safe for Christians, lasted for a good period of time. Other Crusades really went off the rails. Like the one of the later Crusades, they basically got – the Crusaders got as far as Constantinople, which they then proceeded to sack even though it was a Christian city. And this has been a huge wound on the memory of the church that has caused problems dividing East and West. It's really not great to go in and sack the Christian – leadership city in Eastern Christendom of Constantinople. Some of the Crusades, you can look at them and say, okay, they were trying to protect Christians who were being denied access to these territories that are holy sites. They were trying to, secure access to the holy sites for Christians. That's a legitimate goal to have. Maybe they used appropriate means. Maybe they didn't. You can argue about that, but at least the goal was appropriate. But then you look at these other things where you're attacking fellow Christians and it's just not a good scene. So I can't really offer a crusades yes, crusades no answer. It has to be looked at with more refinement. And even during the course of the Crusades that you could look at and say, okay, there's something redeeming here. There's something good. They were still done by sinners. And the thing about sinners is sinners be sinning. So there were mistakes made even in the good Crusades, so to speak. In terms of the Knights Templar, I know some of the basics about the Knights Templar, but I'm not an expert in them. I couldn't really offer a rigorous assessment of them. One of the things that the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and it was headed at the time by Joseph Ratzinger, in the document Memory and Reconciliation, which was produced shortly before the year 2000, one of the things they pointed out is it's very difficult to apply the standards of one period to complex historical phenomena occurring in a different age that were subject to factors that we have now lost track of, because it's very easy to oversimplify our vision of things in the past and forget things, or some knowledge has just been lost to history that would have been important back then for decision making that we can't retrieve now. So it's hard to make judgments about the past in general, and that certainly includes complex phenomena like the Crusades and so forth. I would say if you're looking for resources, I'd read both sides. I'd read people who are saying the Crusades are a bad thing. I would read people who are saying the Crusades were a good thing. And I would expect to use critical thinking and try to sort the good from the bad in both sets of literature. I know one book – now, I haven't read this myself, but based on – it's a book that Catholic Answers publishes. Unfortunately, I don't have time to read everything we publish because I'm researching for my own writings. But one book that Catholic Answers has published is called The Glory of the Crusades. I'm guessing based on the title, it's an on-balance positive view of them. But I would also expect it to have some critical appraisal in it. So you might want to get a copy of that. There are also histories of the church. I know a recent one that Chris Check thinks very highly of is called Timeless by Steve Weidenkopf. You might want to check that out. There are other books as well. I'd go on Amazon and look for books about the Crusades that are critical and read some of that material too, because you don't want to be in an intellectual bubble where you're just hearing one side of things.
Thank you, Matthew, very, very much for that call. Thanks to everybody who called. And thank you to you, Jimmy Akin.
Thank you, Cy Kelly.
Really fun hour.
That's so glad you exist.
I feel similarly,
Jimmy. You make the universe a better place.
I appreciate you saying that. Now I feel inspired to try even harder.
Oh, good.
I appreciate that. Jimmy's, you can find, we talked a little bit about Hitler's religion. You can find out all about that at Jimmy's podcast, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, as well as find out about a whole bunch of other cool stuff. Hey, tomorrow we're going to be with EWTN up in L.A., in Anaheim, at the L.A. Religious Ed Congress. If you see us there, come by and say hello, would you? We'd love to see you. And we'll join you on air from there tomorrow.